Sound policies. I apologize. Let me pull this up. In fact, our policies under the prior government included unsustainable growth based on consumption fueled by credit extension, overvalued currency, very high interest rates, large and unsustainable balances in the economy, continued high levels of unemployment, a large current account deficit. So, honorable members, I'm going to make the case that Minister Davies has actually underestimated the problem, and that the extent of the damage done by the prior government policies, such as what you see here, this is a government policy paper from the Minister of Economic Development, a crash in the manufacturing sector that's pretty much unprecedented. We can look at this across the world and find with platinum and with coal and with plenty of the other commodities and the manufactured products, huge crashes. And I'd like to start by saying that the vulnerability that South Africa faced that led to these kinds of extreme reactions over the past couple of years were not acts of God. They were not natural. They came from public policies, the 1995 exchange control liberalization. I think some of you may remember the financial rand had done the job of keeping capital in the country during the end of apartheid. And the relistings of the largest South African corporations, with one or two exceptions, in 1999 to 2001. And the lack of investment and savings that characterized the last decade, leading to a foreign debt spree. These are some of the things that have made us so vulnerable. And just so that you can see again, the FinRand being dropped in March 1995, leading to those vast inflows of untenable hot money flows, capital that came in, that made, instead of stability, we've been told often enough that the post-apartheid era is one of macroeconomic stability, thanks to Minister Manuel's policies. In fact, you'll see from this graph the extraordinary turmoil in the currency that compares with the nearly revolutionary changes of the mid-1980s. In fact, there's no other country in the world that has had as many currency crashes as South Africa, except our neighbor directly to the north, Zimbabwe. We've had five major crashes measured in the 15% range in this INET bridge. So this is an extraordinary phenomenon if one makes a claim that Trevor Manuel's finance ministry encouraged stability. And of course, the problem that Minister Davies gets to of the high interest rate directly reflects that vulnerability, that when the currency crashes, the Reserve Bank simply puts up the interest rate, and you see we've had the highest real interest rate in South Africa's history. And while it came down a little bit in the early 2000s, by the 2006 it went up again, 2008 a huge increase in the real interest rate. It's still very high in real terms compared to competitors. And that means, of course, that our growth, the 5% growth of most of the 2000s, was in fact based upon hot money and credit, and especially home mortgage advances. You can see how the money supply and the credit markets correlated to the GDP growth. So we had a real U.S.-style financial bubble driving the economy to the point where it really got out of hand for consumers, the household debt ratios by 2008 reaching the 80% of disposable income range. So that's a really untenable level that also was reflected in how dangerous the property bubble became, because the South African real estate, according to The Economist magazine and their international survey, the residential real estate bubble was between 1997 and 2008, 389% as compared to where I was born in Northern in Ireland, at 193%, in the United States less than 100%, which meant that the real estate and construction and sort of speculative property industry did very well. And as you see in the slide there with the red line moving up, the largest growth contributor was the construction industry, although its per annual increase in employment was only 1.3%, and finance and trade, and you see manufacturing relatively stagnant there. And of course, others win from this process. The bankers, who had the highest profit rates basically in the world, along with a few other countries in the 2000s. So these are some of the manifestations of that untenable, unsustainable growth trajectory we've been on going into the big crisis, manifest, for example, in very high non-performing loans that emerged around 2007, and then finally the long-awaited bursting of the housing price bubble. Some say that the housing price bubble bursting has ended, but I think it's still very overvalued, and that's reflected in the mortgage impaired loans and the impaired loans that banks are carrying. Don't take this from me. I mean, this is part and parcel of a whole series of critiques of the South African economy that's now emerging. Here's even the World Bank identifying South Africa's inequality as the worst in the world, the labor force rates about the lowest in the world in the advanced countries, the fact that we've had such incredibly low levels of capital investment, gross fixed capital investment, coinciding not only with the end of apartheid and liberalization, but especially the 1999 to 2001 escape of the headquarters, the financial headquarters of the biggest companies, Anglo, De Beers, Old Mutual, SAP, Investec, Didata, to London. Of course, Gencore became HB Billiton in Melbourne, Liberty in London. And those that slight capital escape, that sits atop an even deeper problem, namely over investment over several decades in length, and over accumulation of capital, over production, and low capacity utilization following it. So these are some of the tendencies that go quite deep. You might argue, well, we've had an uptick in gross fixed capital investment, but once we deconstruct that and take out the sports stadia, the Gautrain, the Dupi, the Kruger, Ghost on the Coast, South African Airways investments, arms deal, we don't have very much in the way of real productive investment. And this isn't being paid for, of course, by local savings. Where does the savings come for these new investments in white elephants? Comes from foreign debt, and the rise of foreign debt is absolutely terrifying. The last time the ratio was at this level was when P.W. Botha did his Rubicon speech in 1985, and the result was a huge financial calamity that led in part to the end of apartheid. I think this could get much worse, and it could get worse in exactly 3 weeks. On March 23rd, the World Bank will consider a $3.75 billion, some say it may go to $4 billion, loan for ESCOM. That's an extreme danger for the climate, for the pressure to increase ESCOM's tariffs, and for, as you see in the World Bank's own loan documentation, the pressure to privatize ESCOM and electricity generation. So this is an extraordinary danger with an addition of perhaps 5% to the foreign debt with all the implications. Why is it so dangerous that we are now listed as a real threat to the world economy? It's because the balance of payments, which is this main declining line you see that starts around 2001, coincidentally when the biggest companies in South Africa are given permission to move to London and Melbourne, those companies take profits and dividends out, and that's what that huge crashing red line represents. You can see at the top a little interplay between imports and exports, and those represent the trade balance, the trade deficit we've been running. It's currently in surplus because of the internal recession, but that's relatively trivial compared to this outflow of profits and dividends. And that, again, don't take it from a left-wing political economist in Durban, take it from The Economist magazine. That record leaves us the most riskiest emerging market in the world a year ago. It hasn't really changed much since then. And I'd like to then add to the dilemma with the IPAP, which is the subject of the second part of the presentation, and I'll really race through one core point because I'm probably out of time. But it is simply that the crisis that I've sketched for you isn't going to be solved by the smoothing the rough edges of Alec Irwin's industrial policy and a few minor changes. And perhaps identifying even the green policy I'd like to address. There's something much more dangerous on the horizon for South Africa, and that is that we have the highest emissions intensity of greenhouse gases pretty much in the world, you can see per person, and also in terms of economic output. When you take those separately, we're right up there. If you take them together, it turns out South Africa's emissions intensity per person in the energy sector is 20 times worse than that of even the great climate Satan, the United States. And so as we see, as Minister Davies put it, a sort of eco-protectionism emerging, for example, the French putting tariff barriers on imported goods because they are coming from countries with high greenhouse gas emissions, South Africa stands terribly exposed, partly because of this problem, the cheapest electricity in the world for, not for ordinary people, of course, we know that from the huge increase in social protests against electricity increases, price increases, but because the biggest companies, BHP Billiton, Anglo, ArcelorMittal, still get the cheapest electricity in the world because of apartheid era deals, corrupt deals, we think, multi-decade deals. Some say these deals should now be and will be renegotiated, but really the best thing is to turn off the electricity to places like Richards Bay, given how little they contribute and how much electricity they use. And instead, to really make good on the promise made by the ANC in 2000 to have free basic electricity, not just the 50 kilowatt hours per household per month that is really tokenistic. Otherwise, this problem, as Zapiro puts it, ESCOM price increases turns into this problem, which is the uproar in the townships. We have now the highest rate of social protest in the world per person, and this is only going to get much worse in coming weeks. I'd like to, as a very final point, say that the industrial policy could take a lesson from history. And the lesson from history is simply that when we go into a milieu, which I'm arguing at the world scale continues to be stagnationist and recessionary, and one of intense competition in which techniques like green protectionism will become very important, it really doesn't make sense to have an export-oriented industrial policy, even one that's slightly modified. A much stronger import substitution approach is going to be needed. IPAP doesn't quite get there. The historic lesson tells us that in the 1930s, when we had full import substitution, because the world markets had crashed, World War II came, and as a result, we had the highest rate of growth per person, but also the highest rate of black wages to white wages, and the best balanced manufacturing development in the country's history. In contrast, the period of globalization, which begins in the 1970s, you can see is characterized by persistent declines in per capita income, polarization, and extreme distortion in the economy, the crisis that we are not yet out of, more vulnerability, and it's time for industrial policy to become much more aggressive in reversing these problems. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I know you're racing against the clock. Depending on which airline you're going, you may be all right, delayed. But members, are there any questions? I'll just take three or comments on both the left and the right side of where I'm sitting. Honourable Maria, yes. Honourable Turok, Honourable Mabaso, and that's three, but I'll also take
our
whip. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I would say if you say that you're did you say a leftist economist? Well, it seems like I'm a leftist then as well. So it seems like we have a bit more in common. I just want to ask you, you've indicated that you know, our fixed formation of the fixed capital investment, it's actually not that substantial, because it seems like you say it's, you know, it's the stadiums, and if you look at the rest, housing and the others, then there's basically nothing in terms of really growing jobs. How do you see one must address that problem? Because eventually we must create jobs and grow the economy and grow the tax base, the revenue base of the country. That is the one thing. And then I want to ask you, you've also mentioned about the dividends that flow out. And I remember, that, you know, in my opinion, that's a huge danger, because, you know, that actually proves that we don't create anything here. It's just portfolio investments. If you look at programs like the automotive industry investment program, isn't that a similar pattern that we're contributing towards dividends and profits flowing out to companies, you know, in America and Japan, wherever? Just your comments on those two issues. Thank you.
Immediately afterwards, Honorable Turok.
Yes. It's a rather interesting presentation given the reply to the debate in the House 10 minutes ago. I don't know if you heard that. The Deputy Minister of Finance responded to a debate in which most MPs were articulating a fairly critical view of where we are and the need for a new growth path. That was the theme from the MPs. It wasn't the theme from the Deputy Minister of Finance. So I think we, as a committee, we should welcome strong critical comments about the performance of the financial sector. But what we really are about here now is to say, if you were Minister of Trade and Industry, what would you do?
Honourable Mawasa.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Also, I express an appreciation for the input. My question is, seeing that most of the countries that develop optimally are those that have a strong basis of training, education, and relevant institutions, universities, technicons. What role do we see such institutions playing? And do we think that they can, in the short term, seriously assist us to go out of this dilemma?
Thank you, Honorable Khadi.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I also follow my colleagues in appreciating the input which is coming from the presenter here. And then the question which I would like to raise here is the presentation raised the issue of the financial rent and the commercial rent which were used in 1995. And I think the way it presents as a problem, because it was somehow safeguarding our currency against. But I think that there's a school of thought outside that the currency must float. When we get the advantage and the disadvantage, if we make a wrong decision in 1995. Number two, part of this impact is to grow the economy so that it can create new jobs. But what we are interested in, when I look at the plan as a whole, is the issue of the financing thereof. Do you think is it adequate to take this thing in a higher growth path?
Well, thanks,
thank you. And I think immediately respond, Mr. Bond.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm grateful for the chance to talk and run. I do hope if you would like, we could continue discussions, and I'm always available on email. I think if I can tackle these in reverse order, yes, the financial rand should not have been dropped, and you don't need to take that from a left-wing political economist. I've also asked Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economics laureate. He said that was an exceptionally good exchange control because it did have a market mechanism, so it did have a sort of buffer that reacted to signals, and it did keep the money, especially of rich white South Africans, the beneficiaries of apartheid, in South Africa, and if they wanted to take it out, there was a premium. So many of the people you'll find, if you identify them by their race and their class, were apartheid beneficiaries who were saying get rid of exchange controls, and that would be one thing particularly to ask, well, what self-interest is there, what patriotism, what commitment to keeping money in the country to help the economy deal with this incredibly low savings rate? I think that's one of the questions. But then you have to get to the other honorable member's question, which is the skills development and what gets taught at universities. And I'll make a slightly caustic comment because I entirely agree with our higher education minister, Bladen Zamande. You might remember one of his maiden speeches as the minister. He said, we have far too much neoliberalism being taught in our universities. So mainly what these universities are churning out in economics, and maybe we have a few exceptions in the room, but most of the graduates are taught to believe in letting free markets go and all of the class and the race biases that entail. I definitely think we need a skills development program. One way to check who needs the skills is to ask these economists, did you predict that half the world's financial assets would be wiped out in a 9-month period between September and April 2008-2009? My guess is that there were no South African economists who study markets, who work on finance, who would pass a very simple skills development test, and then I think some possible remedial action, maybe free trip to Cuba or somewhere where they do actually have some economic training that would have given a sense of that that problem. And I don't mean to be flippant about it, but I do mean that Bladen Zamande's argument that much of what is happening in economics training in universities is entirely counterproductive. There's quite a lot of merit in it. And it then leads us to Minister, to Member Turok's question as to what then would industrial policy do, and the submission I've made includes quite a few comments in some of the areas, but in a very simple way, I learned this from the Institute for African Alternatives back in the 1980s, the adverse conditions under which Africa and South Africa particularly is exporting to a world economy that's so fraught with glutted markets and excess competition from East Asia that we cannot meet, and the huge possibilities we have now for import substitution because of the withering of so much of our industry, our clothing, textiles. And that's not, by the way, the industry that has been targeted in the past, high-quality garments for export to Switzerland, but the clothing for the masses, the leather, the footwear, the textiles, the pots and pans and appliances and electronics, and that's the should be the direction in which we go with industrial policy, which follows the argument that import instead of export will give us higher growth during this period. It brings us to the final point I'd like to make, which is, yes, the gross fixed capital investments have been extremely low, and that isn't simply because we've had some bad policies. We have actually a very deep problem, which we may end up disagreeing with Honorable Murray. That is the problem that private capital has glutted these markets and therefore doesn't invest in expanding its product range in South Africa, with a few exceptions, cell phones and some electronics. But the big problem is a long history of overinvestment by big capital, highly concentrated, which Dr. Roberts will tell us about, when you've got a small consumer base of very rich people, now joined by a few black people. And that problem's gotten worse. The Gini coefficient will show you that. And that means it's not going to be up to the profits to restructure and to bring that capacity utilization back up. It's going to have to be up to the state. And the state then has to actually, in some cases, take over industries, in some cases nationalize, in some cases produce at a loss, in some cases restructure, for example, turning off electricity to Richards Bay so that masses of people get free electricity sufficient to buy appliances, to get markets going. And that's going to take your courage against some extremely powerful vested interests.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bond. I know that you need to leave, and certainly we may well call on you again. This time, hopefully you'll be able to stay a lot longer by coming to a morning session and so on. So thank you very much for that input, and we'll come back to you in writing if we require any further clarification. Suffice to say that certainly the committee itself is of the belief that the cost of capital for our development is indeed a critical factor in the success of the IPAP, and I think the Minister recognises this in IPAP itself, development finance. So thank you very much there. Members, as you know, those of you who may have walked in after this decision was taken to release Mr. Bond a bit early, that instead of beginning at 3:30, we really only started at 4:00, hence the need for him to leave now. But we do have the time now. I understand it's Dr. Roberts, is it? Of course, everyone's listed here as Mr. or Miss or whatever. So I hope... Professor Roberts, yes.
Professor Bond as well.
Well, you know, what makes it easy in Italy, just about... As long as you've got an undergraduate degree, you're a professor and doctor. So it makes life a lot easier. Then you just know, well, someone who's been to university can safely call them professor or doctor. Right. But, of course, in South Africa, we have other hierarchical approaches to protocol. But you're very welcome then, Mr. Roberts, to be with us. And... we'd like to immediately go into your comments and submission on the IPAP itself. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here. And thanks for having the opportunity to make an input on this. I'm the chief economist of the Competition Commission. I've also done work on industrial development issues before I joined the commission 3 years ago. Most of what I'm going to talk about is from the my experience at the Commission and the Commission's experience looking at issues in industry, but I will make a few more wider comments on some of the and draw some implications. There's four main areas I'm going to cover. Make some brief introductory remarks about my views on industrial policy. I'm going to talk about competition and competitiveness. Look at some of the sectors the Commission's working at and what relationships that we can draw out from that and learnings from the Commission's work for the IPAP, and then the final comments at the end. I think from my experience, my work, very supportive of the thrust of the IPAP, particularly about the point that the IPAP and industrial policy generally is about making choices. If we don't make choices, we'll continue on the same path. And the path we're on is a path which is essentially a development path focused on energy-intensive, large-scale, capital-intensive industries. So we have to make those choices. I think what we've heard is that we should make much stronger choices than in the IPAP, but I think the IPAP is a major step forward. South Africa's performance has been very poor. Even in the, as the IPAP says, where we've had high growth, we've had very poor employment outcomes, even at the highest growth rates. There's been very little dent, really, in unemployment. And the other thing I think that the IFIP emphasized is it's been very fragile and structurally weak, being consumption-driven, consumption spending based on household debt. And so we really need to start from that premise in order to look at what industrial policy needs to do. I think that we should take heart from a lot of work that's been done on comparative experiences, and the IFIP draws on Brazil particularly. There's a wide diversity of experience out there. Countries that have tried things differently. In actual fact, there's a menu of options if one's brave to look. And I think the Brazilian experience is a very useful and important one. And IFAP draws in a couple of areas that are very important. But I would emphasize going perhaps even further in a number of areas, and particularly looking at the importance of coordinating industrial policies with other policy areas, macroeconomic policy in particular. And lastly, I think in terms of framing industrial policy, we need to understand we're not correcting market failures. We're talking about markets which are imperfect by their nature. This is an intrinsic feature of market economies. They're very imperfect. And what we must do is we must work with that reality, not try and correct the market failures to get to some kind of perfect world of perfect free markets. And that's where I suppose I come in the Competition Commission, because we, I think, better than anybody else, understand how imperfect those markets are. They're real markets controlled by small numbers of people who determine the outcomes in the economy. So essentially, we need to start from a premise, I think I would argue, and I think the Commission's experience bears out, which is that large firms, a small number of large firms, determine the outcomes in industries in terms of employment, investment, production, incomes. They're not faceless, they're decision makers. And what industrial policy is about fundamentally is about strategically engaging with the decision making of those firms. Because that's how you get those outcomes, is by influencing and changing decisions of the firms. Now, where we are today reflects past decisions. So the patterns of competitiveness, which are the industries that are performing well, industries that are competitive, are the industries that are able to export. Those reflect past decisions about industries which got particular access to energy, to capital for investment, to infrastructure. Those are the interests and the firms that we face, and so the economy is very skewed towards those areas, and the IFAP has a chart which shows the development path and shows essentially that the industries which have been growing over the last 16 years are the same industries that were strong under apartheid. These are the energy and resource-based industries, the resource-based commodity industry. Those are not industries that create jobs. The diversified manufacturing industry have performed very, very poorly. And I think the IFAP is correct in terms of saying we have to deal with that. Now, from the competition point of view, I'd like to emphasize that we've got the persistence of anti-competitive outcomes. Now, this is the most obvious where you've got explicit cartels, but you've also got it in terms of dominant or single firms, where you haven't got cartel conduct, so a group of firms getting together to rig a market, but you've got entrenched single firms. Those firms act in their own interest, of course. I mean, you know, they're out to make money. But they have a negative effect on all the firms which depend upon them for their inputs. Now, telecommunications is just one example, but when you're talking about manufacturing industry, firms are taking inputs and they're adding value. They're adding value to things that they must pay for. Whether you're making furniture, you must pay for the wood. Whether you're making clothing, you must pay for the yarn. Whether you're making automotive vehicles, you're paying for the inputs, the plastic, the steel, etc. And what we're seeing is that in many of the upstream industries, that's where the market power lies. In the diversified downstream industries, which are building skills, employing people, that they're relatively they're lacking power to counterbalance that. So competition and industrial policy are complementary in that they're both trying to understand market dynamics, because you can't deal with these things without analyzing them. I think one of the strengths that people underestimate in the competition authorities is the ability to obtain information. So only when you understand and analyze things can you deal with it, address it. Then you've got to craft your measures and your policies, and there's complementary areas there in terms of supporting new players, new participants in those industries. Because ultimately, the way you're going to have better outcomes is by increasing participation in those industries. Participation by entrepreneurs, by small and medium firms who can build businesses, make investments, employ people, and take a longer term view on where they're going. I'm going to look at two case studies, and I'm very happy to answer questions around areas that people may be aware of the Commission has worked on. I've just picked up a couple of sectors which have been kind of in the headlines, I suppose, more, and maybe of interest. I'm going to talk about intermediate industrial products. The easiest way to think about what these are is the kind of basic materials that are produced in industries, but they're largely used as inputs. So essentially it's steel, basic chemicals, the two obvious ones, metals, the basic metals, aluminium and steel, and basic chemicals that are used in manufacturing plastic products or a variety of products. And in these two areas, Commission, there's been a lot of competition area, issues, and mostly to do with former state and enterprises, particularly Sasol and ISCOR, now ArcelorMittal South Africa. I think this is the most obvious legacy issue of powerful entrenched dominant firm. It's also very clear where they have a pricing power, how big the impact can be on downstream industries. And let me just pick a couple of examples there. But the other thing is that they engage in conduct to exclude potential rivals because they want to maintain that position over time. And what we learn from countries like, say, South Korea, for example, is that actually they don't allow those firms to maintain that position. If they do, then those firms are regulated much more strongly. What they actually want is dynamic rivalry between a small number of firms in capital-intensive industries. In terms of impact, I mean, steel is the easiest one that's come in the news a lot because, you know, if you're making metal products, if you're fabricating things, people are using, you know, you're employing people to make things out of metal, you're bashing it into shape, whether it's making high-end motor vehicle panels, bonnets, or whether it's making bathroomware, whether it's going into electronic goods, fridges, etc., you're going to buy the steel. And that's one of your main input costs. And generally in metal fabricated products, it's much more important than your labor. It's a much bigger cost item. So a huge impact in terms of your competitiveness is how much you pay for that input. And you've got a single firm that's selling it. In tinplate, if you look at the food canning industry, if you go and walk into the supermarket and you look at tin tomatoes, I did it the other day, you say, look at tin tomatoes. This is kind of import substitution, if you like. And you look at some of those tomatoes, not just your high-end Italian tomatoes are imported, but you'll find some of your basic tin tomatoes are imported. You've then got a tomato producer locally, which is it's the labor picking the tomatoes. They're going to be processed. It's going to be put in a can. It's going to be sold to you on the shelf. The most important single cost in that tin tomatoes is not the people picking the tomatoes. For low wages in rural Limpopo. It's the tin can. That's competitiveness against import. It's also competitiveness in export markets for the deciduous and the canned fruit industry. Now, Mittal decided in April this year to put prices up by 70%. 70%. Okay, now you don't have anywhere else to go. I mean, that's it. They've got a pricing basis. Let's say they justify 70%. Now, what do you do? Well, you know, we investigate. I'm going to show you how we're not the sharp tool to bring down the tin plate price within a month or 2 months. That's not how competition works. But illustrate how we can raise the issues. But it has very, very direct effects on value-added manufacturing and agro processing right back to agricultural production all over the country. And I really wish, whether it's tin beans or tin tomatoes, my friend, just look at where the tomatoes come from. The back of the can when you're looking at the checkers at the shop right or wherever you're shopping, and think about the effect that it might have had. Polymer chemicals, another one, plastic products. In most industrializing countries, the plastic product industry grows much faster than GDP because plastics are replacing metal. They're being developed and shaped, and they're the components. They're almost in everything you're looking at, you're working with. So you should be having a very dynamic, growing plastic product industry if you're a developing, industrializing country. But the key input that you've got is polymer chemicals. And again, you've got essentially a single firm. In most of those chemicals, a single firm, which is Sasol producing those chemicals. We've been investigating that for a long time as well. Fertilizer is another area where we have long-running competition cases, and I can talk about more. That's the biggest input into maize and grain production. Not just in South Africa, in the whole region. So if the whole Southern African region is going to respond to higher food prices globally and increase agricultural production to respond to it, then fertilizer is the biggest input. And we now know, I mean, Sasol has admitted it, it was priced by a cartel. The main inputs to make the fertilizer, though, are priced by single firms that are dominant. So there's a couple of firms that make the main inputs. Those inputs are then blended and produced. And those three firms that dominate the blending and production have a cartel. Now, two of the firms have not admitted to it, so it's an alleged cartel. But Sasol has admitted to it and come clean on the cartel side. The Commission is still prosecuting Sasol on the unilateral abuse on the pricing of the main inputs. It accounts for 70% of the plant nutrients. Ammonia. Half the ammonia is a waste byproduct. The other half is produced using natural gas from Mozambique, which is facilitated by a government, which is actually regulated in price. But the ammonia is priced, which is the single biggest input to fertilizer, is priced as if you put it in a ship and brought it all the way from the Ukraine, put it in specially heated tankers, Durban docks, brought it all the way up to Secunda and offloaded it. You've got to keep it because it's explosive at a very high temperature. In special tankers. That's the pricing of ammonia. Import parity, Yuzhny, which is the Ukrainian port that you ship the ammonia from. If you don't ship the ammonia, it's getting made from the natural gas from Mozambique built, coming in the pipeline. It's the kind of same issues, therefore, we might think of excessive pricing of broadband infrastructure for BPO. And the Commission's referred a case against Telkom on the pricing of its broadband backbone. And then we have cartels all over the place that I can talk about more as well. The key thing is, if we don't address these things, then we're telling our small firms, our downstream firms, to fight with their arms tied behind their back, basically. So it's for us anyway, it's a core issue. Food is the other area. So intermediate industrial is about changing the balance between the large capital-intensive firms and the broader firms. I think this is reflected in the IFAP. I guess what I'm doing is essentially adding to it and saying more power to your elbow. In food and agro-processing, similar types of issues. And again, I think this is a good example of where we had a kind of wholesale liberalization, 96, 97. These markets were regulated. There was a potato board, a tomato board, a maize board, a wheat board. They were regulated. We believe free markets were the way forward. Free markets means lack of government regulation. What we discovered is that that's not what free markets are. Lack of government regulation means private regulation. We have cartels everywhere. So we have cartels in bread, in wheat flour, in mealy meal, in milk, in cases in poultry, etc. I've talked about the tinplate and the fertilizer and the storage. I mean, some very interesting things happening in the Eastern Cape where they want to increase maize production, but you need storage facilities. So you can't grow more maize, you can't store it. The silos, of course, were built by the co-ops, but in the Eastern Cape, there's a lack of storage. So the Eastern Cape provincial government is involved in building silos and growing maize production. So there's a very important role for government and for cooperatives there. But in general, at the processing level, the large firms of processing have taken the power. It's the milk processors, the case milk is about Parmalat, Clover. In bread, we'll know it's Pioneer, Premier, Tiger, etc. That's where the cartels have been most effective. We're also investigating retail, a whole set of issues there. But so we're finding cartels, we're finding, uncovering what is really a history, because we're backward looking, and it's legally driven and takes a lot of time. You know, we can't just go out and say, we believe you're guilty, therefore you're guilty. You should prove it, and you can appeal. So, you know, the milk processes have taken us to all the different courts in the land, and other steel producers are now in the high court saying we don't have rights to documents, etc. So that's what we do. And then the question is, well, what's the effect now we've uncovered it? What happens? It's a difficult question, because we feel good when we feel that we've done something because we've uncovered the cartel. Look at the bread prices. And I think this is a reality check, essentially. So the bread producers were, if you want to read the tribunal decision on Pioneer, it's quite interesting. I mean, they were meeting all over the place, essentially. And until March 2007, which is where the line is, to decide their price increases. So what happened after March 2007? After March 2007, the wheat price more than doubled. This is all expressed as a kind of price of the inputs to a 700-gram loaf. So you need 556 grams of wheat. So this is the price of 556 grams of wheat. Locally, most of it's produced in the Western Cape, and we import about 30% of our needs. So the wheat price doubled globally. you can see that took it up from one rand a loaf to 2 rand a loaf. So the bread price went up, and there was this big thing about how are the companies putting the price up after the cartel? Are they covering getting back the fine they paid? But the cost, the input cost went up. The flour cost, which you can see there's 500 grams of bread flour, went up, and then the bread price went up. The bread price went up by more than the input cost. But then the wheat price went back down again. The rand strengthened, international prices came down, and the wheat price had gone back down close to where it was before. And even in nominal terms, the flour price has come down somewhat. The bread price has not come down at all. Yes, the bread price hasn't come down. I mean, apart from the specials you might see on the end of the month, etc. These are the CPI data per loaf. So the reported stats to say of brown bread and white bread, 700 gram loaf, up to October 2009. Okay, they haven't come down at all. The margins opened up, and the milling companies after the cartel made record profits. They made bigger profits than they made before. They're going to say, well, of course, the cartel didn't really have an effect because we found the cartel, it stopped, and we're still making the money. So what does that suggest? Well, what about the impact of enforcement? And this is where I think the complementary issues with industrial policy are crucial. It's crucial to say different institutions and policy measures must work together. In terms of competition and enforcement, much needs to be done. The cases are about the past conduct, and they take a lot of time. The Sasol fertilizer cartel, Sasol, Omnia, and Kainuk, was referred in 2005 to the tribunal. It has not been heard yet. Okay? It was referred in 2005. Sasol admitted last year. Omnia and Kainuk are still fighting the case. You say, well, we should move more quickly, but it's a legal process. I mean, they're right, the people have, we accept that, but it's just important for us to see. What can we do about it? Well, there's a whole range of things here. I mean, we need to look at other ways in which the conduct continues. We need to look at ways in which the conduct can be undermined through new players coming in. I think in terms of bread and milling, we as a commission are looking at, for example, ways in which smaller bakeries were kept out. Because if there's nice juicy margins in bread, if we look at it, this should be great for township bakeries to come up, small-scale bakeries. Bread is not a large-scale operation. You can bake bread, small-scale, there's nice juicy margins here. So we're looking at how you can increase participation. But the second thing, of course, is that there's a cartel in flour. So if you're a bakery, you have to buy the flour. So we're looking at all the way back through the value chain. And you have to get finance in order to build your bakery. An interesting instructive story about a small bakery built in Alex, which is just growing. They had, first of all, had problems getting flour. They've now got flour. They also had problems getting finance. These are the practical things about growing employment in bakeries close to people serving local communities. So we have to look at all the related conduct. There's a lot of information exchange that firms do, which allows them to monitor each other's behavior, and maybe they can run the cartel without meeting in the hotels, pubs, etc., where the meetings really do take place. So we have to look at all those complementary measures. But we also have to look at disciplining large firms, which has been has been less effective. Like, they're very ineffective, but it's been less effective over time as well. Let me build on that a little more concretely. So under competition law, we can continue working our way, which is what we're going to do. We can have increased deterrence, which is why we've appealed the Pioneer fine. We think the Pioneer fine is too low. Because actually, the Pioneer fine was 10% of bread, 195 million. But if you as a cartel are putting your prices up by, say, 2 to 3% a year, and you only get caught once every 5 years, then 10% isn't enough of a deterrent. So we're actually saying you need to have a bigger penalty, and of course we have criminalization coming in as well. We need to look at ways in which the entrants are excluded, ways in which new players can get in and undermine the old boys' clubs, because there are old boys' clubs. There's a kind of anthropology of cartels to be done here. You need to trust each other in a cartel because all of you want to cheat. All want to get nice juicy margins, so you all want to cheat. That's why they had to have meetings all the time, because people were cheating on their agreements in the cartel. It's like fixing a match and then you fiddle it some other way. We've got more powers coming in, market inquiry powers. There's also a power complex monopoly, so we're going to work very hard on those powers. But I think it's the other measures that are in IPAP that, taking so much time that we can go into a bit more. In terms of those, the very large firms, the very large upstream firms, Sasol, Mittal, et cetera, which have received and continue to receive a lot of support from the state, not necessarily explicitly in terms of investment subsidies, but they're getting advantages of the energy and the infrastructure. The energy is still there, for sure, but infrastructure, et cetera. If you have a partnership with business, then in a quid pro quo, you shouldn't be engaging in the kinds of practices which they've been engaging in. If we were a developmental state, we're operating in the way that developmental states do. That quid pro quo means providing those inputs to downstream industries at competitive prices. We need to have a much more strategic approach to development finance to bring new players in, and I think that's starting to happen. We need to have improved regulation. We need to look at regulation, because where you've got very entrenched dominant firms, you've got to think, well, what other sticks have we got? What other levers are there out there? If exports have been used to create scarcity, which is the case in, say, steel industry, where there's still large portions of steel being exported, or in some of the polymer products, then China, for example, said very explicitly to the steel and aluminium industry, you're not going to export low-value added steel, otherwise we'll put an export duty on. So there's a 10% export duty on basic aluminium, basic steel in China. And we're not giving you all these subsidies, whatever, to build your steel plant, for you to export the product and create a local scarcity and drive the prices up when there isn't really a scarcity. So there's other levers that are there. Those are industrial policy levers, and it's not the place of the commission to go into it. Last slide. Sorry for that. Thank you for indulging me, but shut me up if you feel like I'm going on too long. I think this is all about setting up incentive structures for firms taking decisions. So rewind to the beginning. The business people, they're making decisions about what to do. And they're obviously they're not going to give away money because it's a good thing to do, a nice thing to do. They've got shareholders and they're answerable to their shareholders. So we're talking about changing the incentive structure. And the incentive structures need to reflect the future economy we want to create. At the moment, they reflect the past economy. That's natural, past dependency. And we can look at each of the areas. We can look at the competition areas. We can look at access to finance. We can look at the skills and training, etc. All of those areas need to be covered with strong instruments, strong measures. Because you don't change the path of a juggernaut by a little push. You know? And our industries and our economy is a juggernaut. So it's a very big juggernaut or a big tanker, and it will continue to move in that direction. And the things that are still pushing it. The railway lines, the infrastructure is all there. The cheap energy is still there. So there's a lot of things that are just continuing the economy on its way with very, very big, large-scale industry, which, as they get more efficient, are shedding jobs and are continuing to make profits out of their position. We need to look at those incentives always. We need to look at where the demand patterns will change, which I think is what our former Patrick, Professor Bond, was saying in terms of local supply for local needs. At the most concrete level, that's the bakery. That's the Alec bakery. Okay? It's the plastics industries making household goods. It's the electrical goods, the fridges, etc., where the steel price is important. It's the tin tomatoes for people buying tin tomatoes, you know, as opposed to an imported product. So demand patterns are very important. As income patterns change, those demand patterns will change. We need to answer them with relevant support measures. So what we need essentially is to have an incentive structure oriented towards dynamic gains, not rent-seeking. Not lobbying to retain positions. My one comment about macro policy is that the macro policy needs to recognize that prices are set by firms in imperfect markets as well. And the concrete case study that I'd like to put forward is that where you have concentration and collusion, implicit collusion, but just concentration, prices move up very quickly, but they don't move down. What you see in bread, you see in other food products. When the wheat price went up, and as the rand depreciates, all the traders' inputs go up as well. Prices go up, but they don't go down. If we have a volatile currency, it puts all the prices up when the rand depreciates. Volatility means the rand comes down again. It gets stronger again, went back down to 650. But the prices didn't come back down again. So when the currency depreciates, you have this inflationary push right through. But if the prices don't come down, the Reserve Bank is there saying, well, the inflationary push happened, let's put interest rates up. But that inflation stays in the system because of the market power of the firms. So the real world is a world where those inflation is not just an average measure, it's an average of all those decisions taken by firms. So look at healthcare costs. Those are decisions taken by the major healthcare providers, particularly the big three hospital groups. This is not a kind of free market in the sense of lots and lots of firms running around, it's a market of three firms who take decisions. And so macro policy needs to take those things into account, and it has a particular impact or particular implication for exchange rate volatility because of this asymmetry. There's been a lot of work done showing that this asymmetry exists, and price volatility, exchange rate volatility is inflationary. We have higher interest rates partly because of exchange rate volatility coupled with market power, which will not go away overnight. So we really need to think about our monetary policy. I think our industrial policy needs to be regional in vision and implementation. I think we're looking at a structure of industry which is not South African, it's Southern African. It cuts across. The fertilizer cartel is something which affects the whole region, and it has knock-on effects in the sense that it affects agricultural production in Zambia. Zambia is not growing agriculture, they're not going to be buying our manufactured products. And we're the workshop of the region. So these large firms don't see a country, they see a region. The fertilizer cartel is a regional cartel. The cast concrete products cartel is, you know, cast concrete products you see going into water pipe. It's a regional cartel. We referred to that a long time ago. They carved up the whole region. Mozambique is yours. Zambia is ours. Malawi is yours. Swaziland is ours. Two subsidiaries, one of Marion Roberts and one of Aveng. And you know, this affects infrastructure, etc. So we need to think about it regionally, but there's a linkage effect there. Dealing with these practices will have an effect on demand for South African products. The last point, institutional framework is absolutely crucial because we need the information gathering. The IPAP will not succeed without information analysis. And to do that, we need to draw on the information bases which exist. I think I'm illustrating today that the Commission is one of those information bases. The IDC clearly is another. But without the ongoing strengthening of the analytical base, you can't decide on what the measures are. I think the IPAP has a regular review, and it's not claiming to be the Rolls Royce. It's saying, let's continue moving forward with strong political will in a particular direction. Being honest about the problems, not pretending we're doing better than we are. Coordination and regular monitoring. Now, this is a big challenge, obviously, for governments, and important in the institutional framework. And the Commission is just one cog in that. I'd just like to leave that there. Effective tools and levers. I think I commented on that where we said, well, how do you deal with large dominant firms? If you don't have effective tools and levers, then your policies and your measures are not credible. Firms don't believe you're going to do the things you might say you're going to do. So the effective tools and levers, if they are effective and they believe you're going to use them, you won't have to use them because there'll be a change in conduct. So credibility, and this is why we get, as a commission, we get leniency applications, because firms believe we might find the cartel, so they come and tell us about it. They didn't tell us until we started being successful. But, you know, I've given the China example of the export duties on steel and aluminium. You know, you're not going to do this. We'll put an export duty on. We'll hurt you somewhere else. Broadband pricing, no issue there. If you wait for the commission to sort out broadband pricing, then Telkom will take us through all the courts as they've been doing. But we've referred the case, and we've got our analysis of the problem. And that, you know, that's there in our papers. Let me leave it at that point. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Roberts. It's over to us here. Of course, we have a little bit more time this around. So let's see the hands from both this side and the other side. Honorable Khadebe. Yes, Honourable van der Westhuizen, Honourable Marais, looking on my right again, Honourable Turok. My apologies. Honourable Grayling.
All right, thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think the first thing a person has to do is to appreciate what the Competition Commission has done in the economy of this country, in particular in the defense of the downtrodden masses. I think you should grow in strength day by day. But what I'd like you to answer me in is that we see that the IPAP itself, it puts a lot of emphasis on competition between the companies, smaller players, whatever it might be.
do you, as a competition commission, ready to take that challenge? Because you can see that these cultures give you a lot of runaround. So if you're now given more job to do, are you going to be ready to that? What support do we need from the side of government in order to implement the work we're supposed to be doing? Number two, the competition is not only amongst the firms within the country. Our own firms, they compete with firms from outside. For example, in agricultural sector, our products have to compete with products which are coming from the United States, coming from what, European Union. We know that those products are heavily subsidized. So when our firms have to compete with those people, is there anything which we can do so that we can make help them so that their products can better compete in the international world? Do we have to subsidize them? Do we have to subsidize their credits? Whatever. What is it you are suggesting? Number two, the issue of the import parity. I think that's one thing which bedeviled our economy in the past, in the steel, in the wheat industry, whereby people are producing in rand here, but suddenly our own people within the country, they sold this thing basically in dollars to get upon. So what is your attitude towards that? Must we ban this issue of import parity? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Come over to Honourable Maria. Honourable Van der Westhuizen instead.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you. I'm going to play a bit of devil's advocate. If it is so that some South African firms are making exorbitant profits because of cartels or monopolies, etc., where does that money go? Doesn't that money go back into the South African economy? And can't one then say, if you want to be on their side and plead their case, that, you know, we're not really harming the South African economy, because the profits that we're making allow us to take other risks or allow us to turn out bigger dividends or to pay higher salaries to our staff or to invest in infrastructure, etc. Your reaction to such a devil's advocate argument, please.
Thank you very much. And then we have the Honourable Maria, please.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to comment you on the work that the Competition Commission has done, and I think it's a very, very important organisation in our economy. The perception that people have on about the Competition Commission and its work is that if you are successful, then we will see lower prices. So in other words, more competition, more controls, lower prices. But I sometimes get the impression is that your emphasis is not necessarily on lower prices, but rather on anti-competitive practices in nature. So typically what we've seen with the bread prices is that, you know, products stay high. So if some firms make higher margins and consumers are prepared to pay, then it seems like anti-competitive actions by you don't really affect their prices. So on that I want your response. And then also, how do you foresee and what measures or incentives do you would you propose to have that anti-competitive pricing practices that you're trying to expose will have on more labor absorbing on the downstream industries? Because again, I mean, more competition doesn't mean lower prices, so it doesn't mean necessarily more business. So how do you see that incentives and measures can increase that and turn it around? Then on regional issues, and if I can add to what a colleague on the other side of the floor has said about that, is that what we see in South Africa is that garments or clothing coming in from neighboring SACU countries is cheaper than the cost price of the raw material in South Africa. That's within the region. And we see factories closing down because of anti-competitive actions within the region. So how do you see your role there? Because, I mean, we can have fantastic ideas and we can have fantastic plans, but if it doesn't work out in practice on the ground, then obviously it's just wonderful ideas and no competition or effectiveness of the competition. And obviously part of that is what Sadebe said about the subsidized imports and what effect one can have on that. Then lastly, should the emphasis be on decreasing prices? What we see in some industries, for instance the automotive industry, is that there's a lot of import tariffs on manufactured vehicles, obviously to support the manufacturing industry in South Africa. But you see the vehicles manufactured in South Africa being sold at a higher price in South Africa than those same vehicles that is exported to other countries. Obviously that is obviously not benefiting South Africa's economy, and because it doesn't benefit the consumers as such. They need cheaper cars and not more expensive cars. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Freyling. Honourable Tuam. You sure?
Thank you. I was interested, what is the rate of profitability in South Africa for companies? Because I read somewhere that our rate of profitability is in fact a lot higher than in other countries, and I'd just be interested if you've got any kind of thinking on that, and whether that in fact then also adds to our income inequality in South Africa, because I imagine that if it's a high rate of profitability that would do that. Then the issue of export duties, I mean, I think it's quite an interesting suggestion that you put forward there, but I just wonder whether firms would then react to this, because I mean, South Africa is clearly, our economy seems to be built on this minerals energy complex where we seem to be exporting a lot of our primary commodities and not using it for our own benefit. I just wonder whether that won't lead to a lot of companies then choosing not to kind of exploit those minerals in that way. I'd just be interested for you to unpackage that a bit. And then you say that you need a bit more teeth, or that the deterrent isn't high enough at the moment. But we did actually make an amendment to the Competition Act just a little while ago, and in fact for that very reason. Has that amendment not been strong enough? Is this something that needs to be re-looked at? Because, I mean, we even looked at possibly criminalizing the act of price fixing. So do you feel we need to go a bit further in terms of that? And then just the Tim Tomato one that you give us that... example of why is the local price of tinned sheet more expensive here than it is, say, in Italy or wherever else these tinned tomatoes are coming from? I mean, if you're saying we're producing the metal here in South Africa, what is it that's pushing? Is this just a straight case of profiteering, or what is it that is pushing that up? Because, I mean, this is something that I'd like to look at. And then you say we can use other levers such as regulation. I'm wondering what you mean by that in terms of it. Because, for instance, I've noticed now the Department of Energy has seen the high rates of profit that have occurred within the gas industry. And that they, I mean, I'm thinking that's probably something for the Competition Commission to investigate. But they've said that the best way for them to deal with this is to regulate the price of gas. Is that the kind of measures that you think that the state should be looking at, is kind of regulating the prices of certain commodities in order to bring that down?
Thank you, Honourable.
Yes, thanks very much. As always, brilliant presentation. I think our problem is partly that we've been very unclear about the meaning of the word competition. You know, in previous years, we were always told South Africa must be more competitive. Always. But what you've indicated is that there are three areas of competition. One is competition between South African firms, and you've dealt with that. The other one is competition against imports. And the third one is competition in the international environment. They're all very different kinds of competition. And it seems to me that perhaps in our discussions here, we've conflated all three, and so we're thoroughly confused. But what do you mean by competition? You've been very clear today, but in the past, really, we were told the South African economy must be competitive. Business Day tells us that every day.
They don't unpack what you mean by the word competitive. Clearly, we need to be competitive. But where and how and in what market is not spelled out. And I think we need to be, as a committee, we need very clear there are different kinds of competitiveness required. We clearly, if we follow what Patrick Bond was saying, and by implication what you are saying as well, we need some sort of tariff barriers, exclusion, capability. And anything you can add to what you've said, either actual tariffs, notwithstanding WTO rules, and after all, everybody else ignores WTO rules, so I don't know why we should be so careful about them. The United States is breaking them every day, and now Europe as well. So tariff and non-tariff. But my main point is this. You know, this committee is going to have to issue a report and findings on all these presentations. It's going to be awfully difficult because the world out there in South Africa doesn't agree with us, doesn't agree with you. The general view in the media and in quite important circles in government would not agree with a great deal of what Patrick Bond said and what you're saying, and even with IPAP, to be honest. Yes, it's part of cabinet and so on. But the overwhelming view in the country, in policy decision-making areas, is that this is not the right way to go. And you only have to read the newspapers and the financial press in particular, and you'll see that this stuff is treated with disdain. So it seems to me that your presentation, valuable as it is, will only be really effective if this committee is able to formulate a report which gains credibility and acceptance of the sort of ideas you're putting forward. And I imagine that tomorrow there'll be a great deal more of the same. So I'm not sure what I'm saying to you because you're a public servant, but that's our problem. And if all these hearings are going to be worthwhile, and if we're going to write a report which is more than just a summary of A said this and B said that, if there are going to be serious findings and proposals, then we have to be very, very clear on what emerges out of your statement, out of Patrick Bond's and others. And I don't know whether we can lean on you to to make sure that our report is clear and rigorous and effective.
Thank you, Honourable Turok. I just see Honourable Mabasa. Am I correct?
Thank you very much, Comrade Chair. And also let me express appreciation for the input. But I think I'm noting some challenges emanating from the input. The challenges is that even if we have a competition commission in South Africa, but if we don't have its sisters in at least Southern Africa, it means that we will be outwitted. And then having said that, I also note that it means without competition commission being so effective, but at the same time, maintaining that effectiveness or increasing that effectiveness, we run a great danger of the triple BEE not seeing the sunrise or ending at the tip of the sunrise, because the emerging business, for lack of words, will naturally do business honestly, as according to the book, while the key ones, the chief ones, are doing it, in this cruel fashion. So it means that I'm also trying to express that the value of your work is also a value to the development of the small economies. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Thank you. I think this is an opportunity now for yourself, Professor Roberts, to respond, comment where you can.
Okay, thank you. I'll do my best. I'm not sure. I'll a lot of different points that were raised, and I'll do my best in terms of coming to it. I think maybe to deal with the issue that was raised about what are we about as a commission? Are we about prices coming down or just finding anti-competitive conduct? And then gone to profit issues. I mean, we as you know, work with the Act, so we find contraventions of the Act. Okay, so we're not empowered to bring prices down. We don't have those powers. So we find instances of anti-competitive conduct which we've got to prove. So those are firms meeting to fix prices, those are firms charging excessive prices, those are firms excluding rivals. But we do work with the premise that competitive prices are lower than anti-competitive prices. That if four firms get together and decide what they're going to charge for a tender, they're going to do it at a higher price than they would have if they'd each gone in with a competitive bid. So we certainly believe and work for lower prices, and we want more competitive outcomes. And what it does in terms of, say, the bread issues, is it then puts questions to ourselves in terms of our impact to say, well, why are we not having those more competitive outcomes? And that's taking us back to issues like looking at the flour price. Saying, well, maybe the bread cartel is just one part of it, but you can't run a bakery without getting flour. And if you're running an independent bakery, you have to buy flour from one of the big millers, which is one of the big four, basically. Then we need to deal with the conduct at that level. What about other conduct to exclude bakeries, small bakeries that are set up that are told basically to close down by the big guys, otherwise they'll, it's called predatory pricing, they'll predate on them, literally like a predator. So what we're looking at is longer-term work in priority areas, because we get lots and lots of complaints. We're looking at longer-term work, and it's about trying to have more competitive outcomes in terms of lower prices, ultimately. But we don't achieve that price, lower price, directly. We don't have that power. So I think it's worth just going back over that. So if we don't see the lower prices, then we think it's the problem. Because why were the firms behaving that way if it wasn't to make more money for themselves? You know? So we really do want to expect to see lower prices, but we can't regulate those lower prices. In terms of profits, yes, we've got nothing against profits. As the Competition Act, there's nothing in the Competition Act about excessive profits. There's always something about excessive prices. So if you make, what we say essentially is that if you're innovative, you have good service, good delivery, you produce things people want to buy, and you make money out of it, that's fine. What we're against is people making profits without the hard work and the effort. Taking the easy road. So I've heard it described to me as the kind of Friday afternoon speedboat syndrome. That if the managers have all rigged the customers, that's your customer, that's my customer, that's your customer, that's my customer, then they can all go off at 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon with their speedboat because they don't have to work to get the business. But nobody's going to take it away from them because they know those customers are theirs. And if their customers try to go to a competitor, the competitor will not supply them. So we want people to work for their money, to go and quote and go and look for those customers. And that will ultimately mean better outcomes, better profit. The question about profits, I think the danger is generalizing, because often those profits are eaten up in inefficiencies, because if you've got this market sewn up, you can become very lazy and very complacent. That doesn't mean you register higher profits, because you're not investing. You're not investing in your workers, because you don't have to improve their productivity or their quality or their knowledge of the job, because you've got that market, you've got the sales, whatever. You're not investing in better machinery, and you yourself don't have to work very hard because you've got it. So you may not make the higher profits at the end of the day. You see high profits in parts of the industry, other parts of the industry. The other thing is that the high prices of one firm, the high profits of a firm, might mean lower profits for another firm, because firms are not all selling to consumers. There's firms that are making products for other firms, and that's the steel case. So high profits of Mittal is a transfer away from manufacturing businesses that use those, so it means low profits. So the Harvard Group of Economists said that there's low profits in manufacturing, that's the problem. And they said there's not enough profitability in manufacturing, therefore there's low investment in job creation in manufacturing. As a generalization, that might be true, but it's not a generalization that applies to the resource-based industries, the steel companies. I've written about it. I mean, Mittal South Africa, ArcelorMittal South Africa, is amongst the most profitable, lowest cost, highest margin operations in the world. So there's no doubt that when we talk about, you know, manufacturing struggling, we're not talking about them. And just an aside on the iron ore price that is going on in the press and the threats that are coming up, steel prices going up, import parity pricing, or the pricing that Mittal has been practicing, is the highest price they could pay because the other alternative of the steel can manufacturers is to go and import it from Italy. So they're at, if you're a monopoly, you're going to charge the highest you can get. Why wouldn't you? I would do the same if I was wanting to make money for my shareholders, you know. So if you're there already, it's not necessarily going to get much worse for the downstream firms. What Mittal's now doing is that Kumba, the iron ore, is saying, well, there's a loophole in this very favorable deal. But they'll still get very, very cheap iron ore. They've still got very, very cheap energy. Those firms are going to be competitive even if we deal with their market power. Now, even if we deal with the excessive pricing, they'll still be making money, good returns, because their cost base is very low on energy, on infrastructure, etc., on their inputs. And so we shouldn't, it'll be a threat against us and against, you know, people who will take it on, but I think it's, we need to be very, very mindful of and analyze much more carefully. So people should make money out of the effort and reinvest it in that. In terms of where does it go, well, I mean, a lot of those companies are now owned by foreign shareholders, so it goes directly into those capital outflows. And certainly that applies to most of the big mining and resource-based companies. I think we've internationalized it as an economy. Not just firms that are listed overseas, but the firms that are listed on JSE have got large foreign shareholders, portfolio investors. So the profits are going to the shareholders. The shareholders are not here, necessarily. So it really is profits to exit the country there. I'm going to try and go now back to my. So that's the kind of, I suppose, the big picture of what we're trying to do. Are we ready to deal with it? Well, we're a small institution, and you know, we need resources. We need to retain people, and it's always comes up in our strategic planning about retaining people, building skills. But people get hired by the law firms, by the consulting companies that are representing the people on the other side. So, you know, we lose people all the time as well. So, I mean, it's a challenge. I think, you know, we don't want to complain about it too much, but it's you know, the more effective we are, the more benefit there is from hiring very expensive, well-paid corporate lawyers, and so they come and hire from us. So that's the way it works. In terms of import parity, I've said import parity is the highest price that you can get. It is the highest price. If you're a monopoly, then you've got total pricing power. There's nobody else your customers can turn to. So competition is a way of disciplining the power of large firms. So we're interested in competition, not for its own sake. And the Act is very clear in the objectives. We're not interested in competition for its own sake. We're interested in it because that gives consumers power, gives smaller firms power, because the consumer has power if they can go and buy from alternatives. If somebody says, look, the price is going up 25%, you can tell them to get lost. Why? Because there's an alternative there. There's a competitor. So competition is about rivalry. It's about good rivalry, which is to the benefit of people who are consuming and buying. Import parity pricing is a kind of practice where a large firm has got no rival, and the only rival is the import source. And so you've got to go and look for it from the product from far away. Except where we may have a trade deficit. And then import parity pricing is not the outcome of the large firm's pricing. It's a reality that we have to import. So, for example, people talk about import parity pricing in clothing or import parity pricing in wheat. But we import 30% of our wheat. We don't make enough. So it's not like an artificial scarcity. There is a scarcity of wheat. Okay? If we're going to change the situation, we have to support the wheat farmers through fertilizer, etc. But the situation is we have imports of wheat. It's not, in other words, import parity. It's not pushing the price up to something you don't need to do. We don't need to import steel, you know. We make lots of it and we export it. So making it as if it has to be imported is like a false scarcity. Where we have a real scarcity, we have import pricing, not import parity pricing. It's a very big difference, but it's a very small difference in the words, but it's a huge difference in the in what it means. In terms of the strength of powers, we have criminalization, so it hasn't come into effect yet. It's been passed, Parliament passed legislation, so and we have the other powers, market inquiry, so that's what we're going to work on. We're working on making criminalization be effective in terms of the regulations that have to be put in place. We have, for criminalization to work, we have to partner with the NPA. We don't prosecute the criminals. We don't prosecute in the criminal courts, the NPA does. So we must work in terms of our investigation so that the NPA is able to pick up the baton. And that sounds like a straightforward thing, but it's not, because I'm not a lawyer. I wish it was a law, but you know, it's very, very complicated when a lot is at stake, and you know that the guys on the other side are going to try and find any loophole if you collected the information a certain way, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very, very big thing to make criminalization work. And that's what we're engaged in at the moment with the NPA and with other stakeholders. I think the last thing was about, I'm sure I've missed some things, but the last thing I'm going to come to is the meaning of competition. I think it's important. I mean, we're talking about competitive rivalry locally, generally, when we talk as the Competition Commission. We're talking about you having a few options where there's effective rivalry. We'd all be bored if there was only one soccer team that was any good, you know? We're talking about not having lots, but we're talking about the ones that are there being genuine rivals, really fighting for business, getting better products, thinking about what is going to work more effectively. Then international competition is about the cost base and being able to produce products internationally. That's a different thing. We're particularly looking at where we have a low cost base. We should have lots of competition locally, but there isn't. The firms are using cartels or excessive pricing or monopoly behavior to do that. In terms of view in the media, I mean, the South African media is, I guess, throw stones. The day after we raided the steel companies, we were told the commissioner got a red light. I was going to say an unnamed paper, but it's obvious which paper it is when I say a red light. For overreaching. We've now referred 4 cases of cartels in the steel industry. We're still investigating 3 more. So, you know, we were told we were overstretching and these were honorable, upstanding business people, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. That was what the press thought of us. We're waiting to see. But 4 cartel cases and we're still going. Reinforcing steel, reinforcing mesh, mining roof bolts and wire, fencing wire. Largely the same companies in different forms. In those 4 cartels, and still another 2 or 3 cases under investigation. In terms of the international environment, I think there's this diversity out there, and I think we have to be confident. The Growth Commission, which was a commission set up with World Bank sponsorship, etc., acknowledged the whole diversity of experiences. Countries using industrial policy, exchange controls, etc. Countries are doing it. Brazil has put controls on portfolio capital inflows. So has Chile. Norway has got essentially a state ownership approach to managing their oil reserves, Chile with copper. So countries are doing it and not getting castigated for it. In fact, it works and then they get deployed. But I think you've got to take the jump into the deep end of the swimming pool, and do it with good reasons. So I think that's all I can say on that front. Thanks.
Right, we had actually closed the round of questions, but I was alerted to the fact that the Honourable Ambrosini had a question or comment. So if you can make that very briefly.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was detained by the meeting with my leader. So I don't want to break the procedure. If you have ruled that there are no questions, that there are no questions.
No, I haven't made a ruling. I'm saying we simply closed that last round, but it was not a ruling. That's why I'm encouraging you to be brief.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I perhaps I shouldn't, because mine is going to be a note of deep criticism and deep frustration. The iPad tells us something that we have known for many, many years. Monopolies, cartels are a problem. And this is not new, it's obvious. I come from the United States and I make no excuse or apologies for that, as much as one cannot make an excuse or apologies for being black, white, or we are fact, we are who we are. My Cameron environment, in which I spent years studying antitrust laws, I've seen how they work. Looking at South Africa from the outside, this is a country dominated by cartels and monopolies, and nothing is being done about it, whether it's banks, telecommunications, long-distance carriers, sales, distribution, ports, you can have logistics, and I could go on and on and on. The last time around, this is the fourth engagement I've had with the Competition Commission. And we really don't need at this point of our engagement to be told, at least not I, these basics. We asked them to give us to prepare a document which identifies how much of these cartels and monopolies are entrenched and protected under legislation. Because that's what we want to do if we want to implement iPad. And the second issue that we ask them to look at is how much of the trade practices dealing with subsidies, import barriers, and standard regulations have the practical effect of ensuring the survival of virtual monopolies and virtual cartels, because their job is to break those virtual monopolies. And so I don't accept, it's not acceptable, the argument is the best of the class, it's the best team, and that's where it stands. If it's the best of the class, you're breaking down, you're making compete with itself. It's done all over the world. So mine is a note of frustration, because we are going to have the same presentation in 1 year and 2 years, and these are serious problems to get these countries working, and I think the Competition Commission should begin breaking up things and proposing to us the only thing which can do so, which is private enforcement of the anti-competition laws.
I think that was perhaps in the nature of a comment. Unless you wish to respond. Right. Members, we have come to the end of the day. It took a bit longer because we came in a little bit later. We'd like to thank yourself, Professor Roberts, for your input, and of course that earlier on of Professor Boss. And certainly if there are any outstanding issues you wish to take up, we will correspond with you, and you can do so in writing with us. Just to remind members of the committee that we will be back here tomorrow in this venue at 9 o'clock. We would like to start on time tomorrow, and we have an incredibly long day. It is the whole day from 9 o'clock until basically about 5 to 3 when the three-line plenary begins. There's a spot of tea, and I understand there's some attempt at getting a few sandwiches, but I suppose you should be encouraged to bring a couple of lunch boxes. But the reality is we will be here all day, and we would, I'm not sure if everyone has the program in front of them, and we have certainly got two or three other submissions which couldn't make it on that day, but they will be sent to us in writing. One of them, of course, is on agro-processing itself. So thank you very much for being here at this late hour with us. I would like, I think the whip, Ms. Honourable Kadebe, may wish to ask some members of the ANC to remain behind. I'm not sure. But from myself as chairperson of the committee,